Hi, I'm Chloe, and I will be reading the Bible tonight. The passage comes from Luke 24, verses 1 to 12. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were wondering about this, suddenly, two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here, he has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee. The Son of Man must be delivered over to the hands of sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again." Then they remembered his words. When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the others. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, the mother of James, Mary the mother of James, and the others with them who told this to the apostles. But they did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away, wondering to himself what had happened.
Hey, thanks for that. Hey, my name's Tom. If I haven't met you before, I would love to do that after we're done in here, maybe over dinner, something like that. You have found yourself in church on one of the most significant Sundays of the year. And I just want to spend a minute acknowledging the breadth of the kind of people who might be in the room today on this particular Sunday. We've got a little table coming up on the screen. It might be for you that you're here pretty much every Sunday, this is your normal thing, and you're saying, "I'd like to go deeper in my faith here today. I've heard the Easter story 21 times before, 52 times before, but I'm here to go deeper in what I've previously heard." It may be for you that Christmas and Easter is when you come to church. And I just want to say thank you so much for joining us on such a big Sunday of the year. It may be for you that actually, if you're being honest, somebody dragged you here tonight. And you're here because you love your mum, you're here because you love somebody and you want to just honour them and maybe just get them off your back a little bit. But thank you so much for jumping in with us here today. For some of us, we're saying, "I'm a believer and I want you to strengthen my faith as we look at what Jesus did on the cross." For some of us, though, the events of the last couple of months, big picture and in your life more specifically, have left you with big questions. They left you with big wounds. And you actually come here tonight hurting. You have big questions for God. And actually, maybe that video from Joe really resonates with you in terms of difficult life circumstances, making you question God and sometimes pull away from him, sometimes pushing towards him. And for some of us, you might be here just kind of curious, just kind of checking it out, just kind of poking your head over the fence, keen to see what it's all about, and you're not sure where you stand just yet. As a wanderer, I think you're going to find yourself reflected in the passage in quite significant ways. The plan for today is just to start at verse 1, to move all the way through to verse 12. That's how you know that it's going to be over, and then we'll keep singing and we'll head out to dinner. Does that sound like an okay thing for the next 20, 25 minutes? Good, it'd be awkward if you said no. Let's do verse 1. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. The timeline for all of this is that Jesus dies on Friday. Saturday is the Jewish Passover, and so his body sits in the tomb untouched, and it's Sunday morning. We would call the first day of the week, usually we call that a Monday. They called it a Sunday because the Passover was Saturday. And so it's as soon as possible. The women have got their spices. They're going to the body. Archaeologically, we know that they're probably not going to embalm him because that's not what they did in that place at that time. But they are going to use the herbs and the spices just to make the smell chill out a little bit as they're going to planning on visiting this grave over and over again. Verse 2, they found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. And what you get is the sense that they went looking for one thing, and that was their dead Lord. They went because they wanted to use the spices on his body, but they didn't find the thing that they went for. In fact, they found something that they weren't expecting at all. The little stone that goes over the front of the little cave has been rolled away. And what this does in verse 4 is it makes them start wondering. Notice one thing, by the way, before we go any further. They didn't jump to the conclusion that he'd risen from the dead because there was a stone rolled away. In verse 4, it says that they were wondering. If you want to fill that in a little bit, maybe they were wondering, hey, where did they take Jesus? Somebody has come, they've taken Jesus and relocated him. Maybe because he was a political figure who was being a bit annoying for the Romans at the time. That's partially why he's been crucified on the Friday. Maybe they didn't want people visiting the tomb and venerating him. So they're starting to come up with ideas of what has happened to Jesus' body. I want you to notice that they're looking for naturalistic explanations of what's going on. They have not jumped to the conclusion that he rose again. Verse 4, while they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. Now, if you come to church predominantly at Christmas and Easter and not many other times, you would be entirely forgiven for thinking that there must be angels on every page of the Bible. Because when you come at Christmas, there's like shepherds in a field and an angel shows up to them and an angel shows up to Mary and then another angel shows up to Joseph. And now you're here on Easter and there's angels showing up to the women at the tomb and you're thinking, this must just be one big book of angels. Tricky is, angels are actually absent from most pages of the scriptures and most books of the Bible have no mention of angels. When you see an angel in the Bible, it's kind of like a brutal yellow-colored highlighter that says something very significant is happening here. This is a moment where God has punctured the divide between heaven and earth. Pay attention to this moment is what an angel showing up is meant to tell us. And at the same time, as 21st century modern people, we have a bit of skepticism. And we say, angels, really? There have actually been certain movements in recent years to try and demythologize the Bible and to say maybe we could just get the good bits from it. Maybe we could get the morals from it. We could get the ethics from it. We could get the good teaching about how to live our lives from it. And we could just kind of gently white out the bits that seem a bit too miraculous to be true. We could just demythologize this thing. And it would serve as this excellent basis for some of our educational institutions. We'll found them on Christian morals, but we won't need any of the miracle stuff. Problem with that is that at least if you study the book of Luke, just the book of Luke, you're not left with much by the time that you cross out all the miraculous stuff. Right, first couple of chapters, it is Jesus and a virgin birth. So you've got to cross that bit out. And then you get some nice teachings along the way, and they keep being annoyingly interspersed with supposed miracles. So you've got to cross those bits out. And you get all the way to Luke 24, and there's angels showing up, so you cross that bit out. And you've definitely got to cross out the crowning pinnacle of the whole book, which is this guy supposedly coming alive again from the dead. You're left with only a couple of sentences, really, in the book of Luke if you try to demythologize it. Here's the thing. When we read the Bible, we actually are being presented with supernatural claims of unusual things happening, of moments when God did get involved in our world in the most obvious ways. It's asking us to step into a different understanding of the world from our closed sphere where nothing happens outside of what is scientifically observable. Let's talk about angels for a second. If you've been on a Europe trip recently, you might have been in some big cathedrals, you might have looked at some stained glass windows a little bit like this, and you say, this is my image of angels. For some reason, they're always little babies, and I really don't know where they get that from when you read the Bible. But this is kind of a peaceful image, it's kind of a lovely image. Maybe you accompany it with like a choral soundtrack and a sun setting through over an English countryside, and you say, angels. Maybe this is your image of angels. I went on a little bit of a dark tour of Instagram this week, and there is a corner of Instagram called Angel Core. It's like apparently it's not an aesthetic, it's a lifestyle, okay? And it's like a way of dressing, and there's lots of pastels and gentle pinks and kind of blues, and you get wings, and it's a whole thing. Depending on where you go, this whole kind of idea of angels pops up in different ways for all of us. But can I take you in verse 5 to the real deal with the angels, the kind of response that they evoke? In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground. But the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead?" And you can imagine their response. We're looking for the dead among the dead. Like, did you see what happened on Friday? Like, they put the spear in his side, like blood and water flowed out separately. Like, he was definitely, we came looking for our dead Lord. We came looking for our dead rabbi. We came looking to venerate the man who has passed away. We're looking for the dead among the dead. They don't really get it. And the angels need to kind of explain it. And verse 6 is really the big ticket. Verse 6 is really the one that makes us all kind of pay attention and say something really significant has happened here. It just goes like this. He is not here. He has risen. He is not here. He has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee, the Son of Man must be delivered over to the hands of sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again. And then they remembered his words. What I need you to note firstly here is that Jesus gave them hints and gave them clues that this was going to happen. In the same moment, they didn't really get it when he said it because this was not their expectation. They did not go to the tomb thinking maybe he'll come alive again. They thought they had a dead Lord and that they were part of a dead end with their whole following of Jesus. And they're just there maybe out of respect. But what happens here is the declaration that death has been overcome. The declaration that death, at least for this guy, was not the end. This is a game-changing idea. The idea that death doesn't have to be a brick wall at the end of your existence, but that there could actually be a life beyond. I'll give you an example. If you've planned any trips recently, I want you to imagine a place that you'd love to go, but you've never been yet. Right? So you say, I'd love to go to France. I'd love to go somewhere adventurous, like Borneo or something. Like, you imagine where you want to go. What you're going to do next with that desire to know about the next place is you're going to ask somebody who's been there. If you don't know anyone, you'll ask the internet and look for people who have been there. You're asking for somebody who's been to the location and has come back to tell you what it's like. Now, if it's true that Jesus rises from the dead, he's that guy with the afterlife. He's the only one qualified to write the TripAdvisor on the afterlife because he's gone there and he's come back. I'll take you deeper into this idea to show you how significant the idea of the resurrection truly is. Most people view the world in materialistic kind of categories, right? Break that down for a second. We live as though the only thing there is atoms bumping into other atoms, and all we are is the most evolved species on Earth out of all of the animals. But here's the thing. That's actually a pretty bleak way to look at the universe. And when you encounter death, when you show up to a funeral that you weren't expecting to have to show up to yet, in those moments, people grieve because in that way of understanding, death is truly horrific. It is the ceasing of all the consciousness you've ever had, and all you've ever had is consciousness. And death is humanity's last enemy. People have started talking about biohacking and trying to kind of get beyond death or at very least extend out our years, but their record is pretty weak. And I feel kind of skeptical they're going to do anything that more than just slightly extend our life expectancy. But death is the end for all people everywhere, unless somebody has overcome it. And the idea of uniting ourselves to Jesus in faith, when we become a Christian and we attach ourselves to him, is that his victory over death actually becomes something you get to participate in the future. That when you die, your death will not be the end because you're united to the one who has conquered and overcome death. It dramatically changes how you think about the end of your life. It dramatically changes how you think about attending a funeral. It actually dramatically changes just about everything about the way that you live life right now. Now, that's all a little bit heavy. So we take a bit of a break, and I'd like to do some linguistics class with you for a second. I know you came to church tonight, you're like, we're going to learn some languages. That's what I came for. Here we go. It's not Greek, it's not Hebrew, we're doing Chinese tonight. You ready? It's going to come up on the screen. I've checked this with a couple of local speakers, but if you want to tell me I've muffed it, then that's okay. The top line here, does anyone know what the top line says? Sir. It says four. It says the number four. And I'm told that you say it, sir, and you go down, right? You crushed it. Good crowd participation. On the second line there, you've got the word death. And it's almost exactly the same thing, apart from the intonation. You're supposed to go down and then up again, so something like, sir. Anyone with a Chinese background, like, give me a big thumbs down, close enough. What you notice about these two words here is that they are incredibly similar. And the way this actually lands in Sydney today is that many hospitals don't have a level four. Because who wants to be on the level that sounds a little bit like the level of death when you go into a hospital? They're building apartment blocks in Sydney right now, and they have level 1, 2, 3, and 5, but no one wants to buy an apartment on level 4. Some people on the back of their basketball jerseys, you get allocated the number 14 or 24, and you say, coach, can I change that? Because the idea of coming near to the number 4 is actually completely not what you want to do. You want to distance yourself from death as much as you can. This is what normal people do. Any idea of death, any concept of death, what you want to do is keep it at arm's length. But you know what's incredible about Jesus is that he didn't just get right up in death's face. He went into death. He went down to death. He engaged with death in the most direct way you can so that he could conquer it and so that our fear over death doesn't need to exist anymore. We still grieve when we go to a funeral because the experience of dying is painful, it's humiliating. But we do not grieve like those who have no hope. Because if you are a Christian here today, the hope of Jesus overcoming the grave, going beyond it and coming back to tell us what it's like, is actually your hope as well. It secures your eternity and your afterlife. He has risen. He is not here. Come with me to verse 9. We're going to go all the way to verse 12. Starting at verse 9. When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the others. The reason there's 11 is there used to be 12 disciples, but Judas kind of quit the team. Verse 10. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the apostles with them, who told this, and the others with them who told this to the apostles, verse 11, but they did not believe the women. They did not believe the women. So you've got two groups here. You've got the group that's gone to the tomb early in the morning, and you've got everyone else who's just stayed back at the house. It's mostly women in this group, mostly men in this group. And we're told that they did not believe the women. There's four accounts of Jesus rising, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the specific thing that Luke zeroes in on that the other people don't make as much of a big deal about is the preeminent role of the women as the first witnesses of the resurrection. So we're going to follow Luke's emphasis here because we're studying the book of Luke. We're going to stay real close to the text as we try and be a Bible church. And so Luke's big thing here is that the women were the first witnesses of the resurrection. Can I try and show how big of a deal that is to you by taking you through a couple of quotes? This is Rebecca McLaughlin. She wasn't always a Christian. She became a Christian. Let's get that one up on the screen. The portrayal of the women in the Gospels, particularly in Luke's Gospel, is stunningly countercultural. How was it countercultural? Because in that place at that time, it should never have been this way, but it was. In that place at that time, men's testimony was valued above women's. And every now and then, someone comes along and kind of comes up with the idea that maybe the 12 disciples, the 11 disciples, they started a religion because they thought it would give them some kind of prestige in life, or they thought they would gain in some way by putting themselves at the top of a new religious order. Now, my problem with that idea is that they weren't very good at inventing religions. Because in that place at that time, if you wanted to invent a religion, you would put a male a group of credible, ideally influential males as your primary witnesses. Luke does exactly the opposite. And it's just a small clue that this whole thing might have more of an edge of truthfulness to it than you might have initially expected. Let's go to the second Rebecca quote. She says, Luke constantly pairs men with women, and when he compares the two, it's almost always in the woman's favor. For example, in Luke chapter 24, who were the ones who get up early as soon as possible? They head to the tomb? It's the women. Who were the ones who are doing I don't know what back in the house? It's the boys. And then the women come back and they say, we've seen the... And the boys don't believe them. And what's happening here is that Luke is giving pride of place and special honor. He even names them directly so that 2,000 years later, their names would be publicly read out. These women who were given pride of place as the first witnesses of the resurrection. So let me bring you this quote from Dorothy Sayers. She says, it is no wonder that the women were first at the cradle and last at the cross. Have you heard that one? First at the cradle and last at the cross. I'll give you the full quote. I'll just read it to you because it's super long. They had never known a man like this man. There had never been such another. A prophet and teacher who never nagged about them, who never flattered or coaxed or patronized, who never made arch jokes about them, never treated either as the women, God help us, or the ladies, God bless them, who rebuked without querulousness and praised without condescension, who took their questions and arguments seriously, who never mapped out their sphere for them, never urged them to be more feminine or jeered at them for being female, who had no axe to grind and no uneasy male dignity to defend. Have you watched the new Louis Theroux documentary? No uneasy male dignity to defend, who took them as he found them and was completely unselfconscious. What Luke is doing is raising the profile of the women, saying, I'm loud and proud about the fact that these guys were the first witnesses of the resurrection. But, verse 11, their words seemed like nonsense. And if we move out of kind of first century Middle East and we come into this room right now, I imagine that for many of us who have come here tonight to check out church, you actually kind of resonate with that and you say, I'm not like against the women as the first witnesses. I just, anyone talking about someone coming alive again from the dead kind of fits in the nonsense category to me. And I just wanted to try and unpack that a little bit and come on that journey with you in two particular ways. For some of us, we think it's nonsense because we're too scientific for all of that stuff these days. We can't believe in that anymore because we are now too scientific. Can I give you something to follow up on, something to put in your earbuds for tomorrow if you've got a bit of extra time or on your commute to work on Tuesday? There's this podcast that I tuned into recently. It's one of the top ones on the charts at the moment. It's Diary of a CEO. And I'm less excited about the podcaster and more excited about the guest that he got on that day. He got on this Christian called Wes Huff. And they were having a 2.5-hour chat back and forth about sources and historicity and legitimacy. And he's throwing some really good questions. He's getting some really good answers. And one of the little moments they have is that Stephen Bartlett, the interviewer, he says, hey, surely we're all too scientific for this now. Surely we can't believe that anymore. And Wes Huff makes this excellent point. He says, we've got to be careful about chronological snobbery. We've got to be careful about chronological snobbery, which at its heart is saying they were silly and we're smart. Or they were unscientific and we are scientific. And putting yourself above by virtue of what moment in time you live in. And one of the reasons that the chronological snobbery doesn't really work, particularly in Luke chapter 24, is because nobody in this story is jumping to the conclusion of a miracle. I tried to pick it up along the way as we went, because when the women see the stone rolled away, they don't say, it's a miracle, he's come alive again. They, verse 4, they wonder. And then they go back to the men and they say, he's come alive again. And they say, no. Nobody in this account is jumping to the idea of a miracle. They are as skeptical as you and I naturally are about the idea of somebody coming alive again from the dead. For some of us, we think it's nonsense because we're too scientific. For some of us, a little bit closer to home, we kind of just discount it. We say it's nonsense because my life is just fine and I don't need that right now. For some of us, we say death feels like it's a long way away. I'll think about that later. For some of us, we say religion is just for weak people who need a bit of an extra something to lean on when it comes to death, and they need to grow up and see the situation like all of us do. Now, on the one hand, you're right, because it actually does help to know something about the one who went beyond death and has come back. On the other hand, if it's okay to say, can I just gently poke and say that's a pretty short-term way of thinking. Every now and then we attend the funeral of someone who we expected to die for quite a long time. Every now and then we attend the funeral of somebody who we thought was going to have a much longer innings than they did. And this is not where we expected to find ourselves at all. And if I was going to be really stark about it, in a room this size, I would be surprised if all of us are here next Easter. Perhaps Easter 2026 is the moment that you decide, I actually am going to face the reality that one day I will die. I want to work out what does happen when I die. Did that guy actually come back from the dead, or do all people everywhere just die? Maybe today's the day to actually tune in to the big stuff of life, and you're surrounded by a bunch of people who would love to have that chat with you and help you take that chat to the next stage. We're right near the end. Let's come to verse 12. Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb, and bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away wondering to himself what had happened. I reckon some of us in the room are wanderers, and we've been poking our head in at this Christian thing. We've been taking a look for a little while, and one of the best nights that you can be at will be the Dave Jensen night, the last one in April. We'd love to have you at Freedom Sunday. He's just going to preach it straight. He's going to tell you how it is, and it'll be on you to decide how you want to respond to that. But what I'd love to do as we move towards a close is give you something specific to wonder about. Something specific to wonder about. As I've kind of done my research and tried to look into this with a bit of honesty and a bit of authenticity and a bit of realism, just stare it square in the face, you start to listen to historians, and not just Christian historians, but secular historians. And what I've found is a surprising amount of convergence in what secular historians think about this Jesus guy. We can pull up this kind of timeline on the screen. For example, pretty much every secular historian worth their salt will agree that somewhere around 0 AD in the Middle East, there was a real historical figure called Jesus. Pretty much every secular historian worth their salt will tell you that he was a religious teacher, gained a following. Pretty much every secular historian worth their salt will tell you that he was at least reported from multiple different angles to be a worker of miracles. You might not believe in miracles, but the people and all the accounts that we have at the time, from people who were against him and people who were for him, are all declaring him to be a doer of special works. And pretty much every secular historian who's worth their salt is going to agree that this Jesus guy actually did die on the cross, a common Roman form of crucifixion at the time, around about 33 AD, just as the gospel accounts declare to us. And we can add in one more piece of history that's very hard to dispute, which is that in 2026, Christianity is now the most globally spread religion. It has the most people adhering to it out of any faith worldwide. You and I are just about as far from the Middle East as you can possibly be in terms of kilometers, and we are talking about a dead Jewish rabbi with a couple of nice teachings 2,000 years later. And the thing I would like to ask you to wonder about is, how did we get from there to here? There were many people who had a small religious following like Jesus did. We're not talking about any of them. There were many people who were reported to be doers of miracles, but we're not talking about any of them. You're sitting in this room 2,000 years later as part of something global. And I would ask you, why do you reckon that is? I just want to cause you to wonder a little bit. Three explanations that have been put forward that all sound quite reasonable when you put them forward. Let's go through them. The first one is that potentially the 11 remaining disciples were liars. We can pull this up on the screen. Potentially, they knew that none of this actually happened. They manufactured it because they wanted to be the heads of some new kind of religion. And when you say it for the first time, you think, oh, maybe. When you think about it for a little bit, you think, oh, maybe not. Potentially, these people were actually convinced. They were genuinely convinced. They really thought Jesus had come alive again from the dead. They were out of their mind. They were lunatics. And in their lunacy, they convinced other people, because lunatics can be very passionate. And maybe potentially these people actually thought it did happen. And then they started convincing other people. And when you hear it for the first, you think, maybe. And when you think about it a little bit longer, you start to see a couple holes in that. Third option is that maybe this is all just legend. Maybe the first followers of Jesus never even claimed that he was risen from the dead, but it just kind of got developed over years and the whole thing kind of snowballed and it got bigger and bigger until people wanted to make bigger and bigger claims about the guy they followed until somebody said, maybe he rose from the dead, and they all just decided that was true. And it's a snowballing legend that develops over time. You think about that idea, and the longer you think about it and the more you look at it, the less convinced I've found it. Now, you won't be surprised by this, but you know, the guy up front of church is convinced that actually he did come alive again from the dead, as crazy as that sounds. And I'll finish with this. Band, you guys can come on up. I actually do believe that Jesus died on the cross for our sins in our place as our substitute. He was dead in the grave. Medically speaking, it was no metaphor. And on the Sunday morning, he was discovered to not be there because he was risen. He has overcome the grave. And when we unite ourselves by faith to him, his future actually becomes a part of our future. And so what we're going to do right now is we're going to celebrate what happened on Easter Friday, what happened on Easter Sunday with this excellently picked song. If you're willing and able, I'd encourage you to stand. We're going to sing. We're going to celebrate everything that happened for us at Easter.